Hey, everyone. First off, we want to thank you for listening to No One Is Coming to Save Us. And now we want to hear from you, what you've learned, what's sticking with you, what questions you still have, and what you're motivated to do as a result of listening. Right now, you can take our short survey to help us better understand the impact of our work. And even better, once you've completed the survey, you can enter for a chance to win a $100 Visa gift card. The survey is short and sweet, I promise, and it will really help us keep bringing you content you love. Take the survey at bit.ly/no-one-survey. That's bit.ly/no-one-survey. Thanks again.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Hey guys, welcome back. I hope you're listening from somewhere cozy and comfy. Maybe you're in your car. I listen to a lot of podcasts in my car. Maybe you're on a walk, which would be lovely. I love walking with my dog and listening to good conversations. Wherever you are, get excited because this episode is going to bring it. This is No One Is Coming to Save Us, a Lemonada Media original presented by and created with Neighborhood Villages. I'm your host, Gloria Riviera. What I love most about this conversation is that I really had to keep up. Do you ever have that feeling when you're trying to explain something and you're sort of here, there, and everywhere, and then someone sidles up to you and just nails it in this extraordinarily articulate and beautiful way, and you say, yeah, what she said. That's kind of how I felt. Angela Garbez is the author of Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. She was also the co-host of Season 3 of The Double Shift, an acclaimed podcast challenging the status quo of motherhood in America. She lives with her two young daughters and partner in Seattle. Shout out to my hometown, Seattle. And she's been all over the press with her latest book because it is so, so, so powerful. During this conversation, Angela explains how this book came to be, how she felt she could not write about parenting during COVID because she was doing it 24/7. It was hard, exhausting work. It was at times boring, but it was, of course, important work. And so she channeled all those feels into a book about mothering as social change. I won't share any more secrets from the conversation, but I will repeat something she said that well into season 2 of this show still stopped me in my tracks. She said during the height of COVID, as we were all celebrating essential workers, she asked herself, what about me? What about parents and mothers? Yeah, what about all of us? Because we are essential too. All right, here's my conversation with a true rock star, Angela Garbez. Angela, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Gloria.
It is an absolute pleasure. We are going to get into it today. And I have to tell you, as I was becoming familiar with your work, so much of it resonated, and I know it will resonate with our audience. This is really the first conversation we will have had on this podcast with someone who is so deeply informed and shares so much of the perspective of, I think, No One Is Coming to Save Us. When you wrote Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change, this year, 2022, is when it was published. What book did you set out to write, and how did that perspective evolve as the writing evolved?
Oh, that's a great question. I was actually supposed to turn in an entirely different book in July of 2020, which if we can travel back in time, obviously those were the early days of the pandemic when we were still disinfecting our groceries and thinking that we could get COVID by touching our mail. And in March of 2020, It only took me a few weeks to realize that there was no way I was going to meet my book deadline, which had been a book of essays about the human body, using the body as a lens that, for better or worse, the body you're born into impacts how the world perceives you and how you perceive yourself in relationship to the world. I couldn't write that book. I asked for an extension, and I got a year to sort of figure out what I was doing with my life and how I was going to begin writing again. I was focusing. I delayed that book because I was taking care of my children full time. I had two daughters. They were 5 and 2 at the time, and I was with them for 4 months straight, 24/7, without any help. It was just me and my partner. And, you know, as a writer, I had this far off deadline. I don't get a regular paycheck. I don't get health insurance. And so it was very easy for us as a family to decide to prioritize my husband's work because he gets us all those practical things with his regular paycheck. And I felt like taking care of my children, keeping them safe and healthy, and in that sense, also taking care of my community, I just knew that mothering and care work was the most important work that I could be doing. But I also had to really wrestle with the fact that it wasn't enough for me, that I really missed my writing work, and that being a caretaker, while important, was, it didn't feel like enough. And I felt myself getting really bored and I felt really undervalued. And around this time, those early days of the pandemic, you know, in New York City, people at every night at 7 p.m. were clapping for essential workers, right? We were talking about healthcare workers, teachers, sanitation workers, and all of those people are absolutely essential. But the feeling that I had that I just couldn't shake was, what about me, right? Like, what about parents? What about mothers? My work, and I am working all the time, around the clock, trying to do some professional work, but also just the domestic labor. There was so much of it because there was so much us and we were all around all the time. And my children still needed, you know, 3 meals a day and snacks. And I just felt like no one's talking about this and we're all stretched. And so that's something I was carrying around, all of those difficult feelings, and also that feeling of knowing, like, we are essential laborers. Parents are essential laborers. I've been writing for a few years, so I had an editor approach me at the end of 2020. I had said something to her to the effect of, you know, this was after 865,000 women dropped out. Sorry, I don't want to say dropped out. It's nothing. That seems very passive. Like, we were forced out of the professional workforce, and 865,000 women left the professional workforce in 1 month. In September of 2020. And this had been building. We'd seen women dropping out, right? And women of color were impacted early in the pandemic because they're overrepresented in service industries, you know, like childcare, like salons. And a lot of those places closed, you know, never to open again. And so I was, you know, swimming in a lot of awareness and bad feelings about how women and mothers specifically were being impacted by the pandemic. But I was just thinking, like, when so many women leave, our participation in the professional workforce and outside of the home is directly tied to our participation in public life. And so I thought, like, what happens if women disappear for a year or more? And so I just sort of wrote about all of my terrible feelings, the way that we devalue labor, and the way that, you know, we hear these statistics. You know, there's now 2 million less women in the workforce than there were at the start of the pandemic. And those statistics are devastating, but they also kind of, they have a way of making, you know, the really painful individual stories and the emotional turmoil that we're all going through, they make them sort of anonymous and invisible, you know, lumping us all together. So I wrote this piece about that. And then and so I heard from a lot of people, and you know, Elizabeth Warren and Melinda Gates, they like retweeted the article. And so I set out to write a book that was a history of care work in America, just really looking at how did we get to where we are today? You know, we have an invaluable workforce of mainly Black and Brown women doing our domestic labor and childcare. This is the work that makes all other work possible. And without them, we're lost. We've seen this as people were scrambling to figure out how to keep their lives together. You know, and we pay them poverty wages. People who work in domestic labor are 3 times as likely to live in poverty as other workers. And I really believe that the reason why we are comfortable paying women of color very low wages to do such important work is because of the legacy of slavery in America. You know, the home has always been a work site for Black women. And that's why now, even, you know, centuries later, we're comfortable paying women of color a much lower wage or demanding this work for free. And I thought, how am I going to do this? Like, I can be really sensitive in my research and inclusive, but like, this is not my, these are not my ancestors. This isn't exactly my story to tell. I'm Filipina. I'm Filipina American. I'm a first generation born here. My parents emigrated in 1970, and my parents are healthcare workers. My mom is a nurse, and for most of her career, she was a hospice nurse, taking care of people in end stages of life. And during the pandemic, there was a statistic that came out that Filipinx nurses are 4% of the nursing workforce in America, but they are 34%. Of COVID-related nursing deaths. I was seeing it directly, like, in my community, in my family, and thinking, you know, this could be my mother.
Right. I mean, as I hear you speak, what strikes me is that you were sort of grasping at how you were going to get into the story, and then seemingly all of a sudden you knew, I can tell this story. I am invested in this story. There's a line, well, there's many lines from the book that just stopped me cold. And one is early on when you're talking about your father who worked as a pathologist. Do I have that correct?
Yes.
Yes. So you say, I wanted to be able to look at things the way he did, see the hidden things only he saw. Though they didn't capture my imagination the way cadavers did, I thought the slides were beautiful. And this is the best part. Stained gradations of pink and purple, unfurling like nebulae in space. I mean, that just stopped me. And it stopped me because I connected it to many, many years later, this perspective on childcare and the hidden things, right? For me, Your book was seeing all of these things. And I guess COVID was experiencing that in real time, these quote unquote hidden things that were completely naked due to COVID. You know, I don't know if that's a complete parallel, but I just read that and I, as a reporter, thought, oh, wait, there's something there that is the connective tissue that brought this book into being.
I love this. That's such an insightful read. Thank you. It's really like an honor to be read with that much care and that much insight. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, my father could see those things. Like if we just sort of kind of carry that metaphor a little bit, many people could see the sort of care crisis that we now, as we now talk about it.
Right.
And the difficulties of care in America and how what passes for our like care structure, which is really, it's not sustainable. People have been like piecing it together. These things existed, it predates the pandemic, right? But what the pandemic really did was pull that curtain away. And there was just no denying that outsourcing care isn't working, especially when your care structure, when all of the people that you hire to do that can't perform their work, when they can't come into your home, and when childcare centers and places close.
Right.
I've heard the word reckoning a lot. Mm. You know, America's having a racial reckoning. We're having this reckoning with care. And to a certain extent, I think that's true, but I think we have to go further. Like, we haven't really confronted the reality.
I know. The question is, what does the real confrontation look like? Because we feel like we've gotten close, right? Especially with Build Back Better, and there was so much enthusiasm. But I do ask you, having written this book, what do you think it will take?
I think it just takes more time. It takes longer. I mean, I voted in the Biden administration because they ran on paid leave. Right? They ran on all of these things. They ran on codifying Roe v. Wade, right? Like these were, these things felt, especially after the 4 years before, they felt like we were on the same page, right? This is, America was realizing this is what we needed and we were going to make these things happen. And so I won't lie, I feel really disillusioned. I feel pretty angry and I feel disappointed in Democratic leadership and in the Biden administration for failing to make good on these promises. But I realize now, okay, I was just maybe a little naive. Like all social change, it's slower than you want it to be. It takes time. And I think, you know, this is how I tie it to, you know, I think about my own parenting and mothering as very much being legacy work, right? I think about how, so these things that I wanted for American life are not going to happen in the next 4 years, probably. They may not even happen in my lifetime, but, they could happen in my children's lifetime and my children could be part of making those things happen. So I think what we need is time and we need more. We need more people. And I think, you know, we need change at every level. We need change at the federal level, yes. But what I'm seeing day to day is, and this is a thing that came out of the pandemic, you know, we formed pods, right? We started talking about mutual aid. We did briefly have the advanced child tax credit, right? We have community fridges, we have little free libraries, and those smaller community-based things are people saying, I can't do this alone. I need help and I need support. And other people in turn saying, I can't do it alone either. And I want to help you. As overwhelmed as I am and as spread thin as I am, I want to help. And I think it's a very human urge to take care of each other. And so I think that I'm seeing that on the very grassroots level. And I want that to continue. You know, my hope and part of writing this book is to try to take advantage of this moment and to say, like, we are in a very pivotal moment. Let's not go back to normal. Normal wasn't working for many, many people. Normal was pretty bad. And now we all know that we share a fate, right? And that those care infrastructures can vanish. Just because they're back now doesn't mean they won't go away again.
Right.
And I want us to lean into our interdependence and ways of making community and, you know, moving away less from the very siloed and isolated nuclear family and thinking more about collective care and collective action.
Have you ever wondered if knowing more is always good? Or if we can really trust our gut? Or how change actually happens? For answers, I turn to Kelly Corrigan Wonders, a weekly podcast I just love. If you haven't heard of her, Kelly has written 4 New York Times bestsellers and has a great show on PBS. Oh, and the Oprah Magazine calls Kelly the voice of a generation. The Huffington Post calls her the poet laureate of the ordinary. Her podcast, Kelly Corrigan Wonders, has thousands of 5-star reviews that emphasize thought-provoking, funny, authentic. It also has over 14 million downloads. She gets real with everyone, from Lisa Damore and Pete Buttigieg to Julie Lithcott-Hames and Mary Louise Kelly. Together, they help us focus on the long game of parenting, create support systems, and keep our lives in good working order. Subscribe to Kelly Corrigan Wonders wherever you're listening now. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. With Greenlight, parents can send instant money transfers to their kids, keep track of their spending in real time, and even manage chores and allowances. It is all about making financial literacy something the family can take part in. We have loved Greenlight in my family. We use it with all my kids. I feel like it's helped them feel all around more comfortable talking, about financial literacy and motivating them to understand how all of it works. Also, it's been really helpful in getting them to do their chores. The Greenlight app also comes with an in-app financial literacy game, Level Up, that helps kids build money confidence through videos, bite-sized challenges, mini-games, and more. Millions of parents and kids use Greenlight to learn how to make responsible financial choices. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/Gloria. That's greenlight.com/Gloria to try Greenlight for free. Greenlight.com/Gloria. It's interesting because in listening to The Double Shift, there were ads for community living in New Mexico. Yeah. And I had never heard an ad for community living. And I think your co-host said, you know, it kind of makes me want to move to Albuquerque.
Yeah.
But it's this idea of helping each other, letting each other know that we are not alone.
Yeah.
And I think that's incredibly important. On this podcast, we've spoken to a lot of community organizers. And I do take hope from the fact that we have climbed steep mountains before, and it's all started at the grassroots level. And it has,
yes,
it has been successful in this country. And as I'm sure you know, this country has done it before during World War II. There were childcare centers across the country because women had to return to work to support the war effort. So we know we can do it.
We can. It's very possible. I mean, I want to just remind us too that, you know, other countries do this, right? This is like, these are not, I want to like bring it down to the most basic level. Like, it's not radical. It is not totally out there to take care of each other, to feel like we owe each other something, and that by just being a human on earth, like, you deserve, you know, certain things. You deserve basic human rights, which we don't guarantee in America.
Well, you deserve to feel supported,
yes,
right? You deserve to feel supported. And when I think about you, and this is the part of you being so relatable, you know, with your young kids right in it for 4 months and having all of these feelings, one of them being, I'm not so sure I would say I'm happy right now. I know the work I'm doing is important, but I can relate to that. You know, my youngest daughter just turned 7. And the fact that we as women need acknowledgement and recognition inside and outside the home if we choose to pursue a career outside of the home. I mean, it's all, I feel like we're parsing through this minutia and saying, you know, I'm essential. Wait a second.
Yes.
I'm essential.
Yes. I would say it to myself in the mirror sometimes, you know, like when I was writing the book, like insisting on it. And I think honestly, we need that level, like that sort of very, very micro level of change of talking about ourselves in that way, talking to our friends about it. You know, like we're not just moms. We are essential workers. We are guaranteeing the further existence of human beings. That's pretty essential.
Yes, absolutely. Part of why I do this podcast is because I have 3 children and I don't want childcare to be what it was for me for them. It doesn't have to be that way. And I'd love to hear, there's so much I want to hear from you about, but I would love to go back to the Philippines and to talk a little bit, if you can share with us, your experience and what you saw from domestic help in the Philippines. I'm really interested in the idea of your mother going back and navigating, I guess you could call it, the power dynamics.
Yeah, absolutely.
When she was back there.
So my parents emigrated and my mom didn't have a support system. You know, my mom worked full time, but she didn't have extended family, right? I think about her, I mean, when I became a mother, I started to really think a lot about how did she do this? How did she raise 3 kids? How did she work full time without an extended network of people?
Right. By slapping herself in the cheek when she was driving, right? You write about that.
Yes, to stay awake.
Yes, yeah, to stay awake.
So my mom grew up with maids in her house. In the Philippines, it is very common to have domestic help. People have maids, they have what they call yayas, which are nannies, babysitters, they have drivers. And, you know, you don't have to be extremely wealthy to have this domestic help. You know, the Philippines is a poor country, it's a developing nation, and there's a lot of people poorer than you, right, in the Philippines. And so, I mean, it's complicated, but it is it's just a legitimate job that people have throughout the country.
Well, that's exactly that phrase, legitimate job. We spent time in China and the whole approach to domestic help was radically different and a very respected role in the family / household. I mean, I say family,
yes,
because so many, the word for it in China is ai. So many ais are part of the family, but also, I mean, to a large degree, they run the roost. You know, it's like, I'm getting out of your way here.
Yeah, no, exactly. So my mom, you know, I grew up in America hearing my mom say, I'm not your maid. Wash your dishes, you know, fold your laundry, clean your room. She involved us in the work of the house as much as she could. And when we would go back to the Philippines, though, it was really interesting because I was confused. I was like, who are all these people in the household? Like, come in and like, when you're not looking, they take your dirty clothes away. And then the clothes just appear like on your bed folded, like a day or two later. You know, they're telling us to sit down while they clear our plates. And it made me a little bit uncomfortable. And I could tell that it made my mother uncomfortable. And my mother, who I think, you know, in coming to America was like, I don't want this. I don't need this for myself. So she would come back and really sort of awkwardly try to maneuver. And then I saw over, you know, over the course of, you know, two decades, she kind of, exactly what you said, was like, oh, there's a way that this household runs, and I'm actually in the way. Like, I'm a massive interloper here, and I don't know the systems, and I'm screwing it up. And she really began to defer to the authority of domestic workers. And, you know, I will say that there's a high potential for exploitation and abuse. Wages are still low, but there is, again, it's complicated, but I wanted to bring Filipino domestic laborers into this conversation because at times it really strikes me as a more honest way of living.
Oh, interesting.
Than, the way we live in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, we don't like people don't, I think people have sort of like class guilt or like class, you know, self-consciousness where they don't want to own up to having a nanny or a house cleaner. And I mean, I've encountered that. And to me, I'm like, if you can afford domestic labor, I think that's great because we can't do it alone. It's far too much to cook, you know, three meals a day, 7 days a week and clean the house and do the laundry.
And like, snacks. Don't forget the snacks.
Yeah. Oh no. Always snacks. Always snacks. And so, I mean, and I really thought about it when on, you know, it was an Instagram post that became sort of a lightning bolt for me. I was looking at this post by my cousin Pang on Mother's Day, you know, like 4 years ago. And it was a picture of her three children and these four women who were their yayas and were the maids of the house. And she was like, I could never raise my children without these women, and named all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, my God, like I've never, I know that it happens occasionally, but I've never seen an Instagram post. Like personally, I've never seen one in America where an American woman says that about her babysitter, about the house cleaner. And to me, I was like, there's something that we can learn from this, right? Like, I want to make this work visible. You know, we say things are like low-skilled labor, and I reject that. I think all work is work. All work has particular skills. And I think labeling domestic labor and childcare as low-skill labor is, it's really a myth that we use to justify paying low wages. And, you know, as someone who took care of her children nonstop for 4 months, I mean, after several days, I was like, I want to lay down and die, right? Like, this is not easy work. Like, this is highly skilled labor, especially the sort of emotional and psychological work, which we're not very good at talking about, that sort of intimacy that develops between caregivers and their charges.
But you see it, right? Like, I'm thinking about my own family, and when we were in China, we were very lucky to be able to bring back our IE, and we would send out a card in December around the holidays, and we would put a prominent picture of IE with one of our children on the card. And so many people would comment like, oh, I thought it was so nice that you include her. And I just felt like, of course, she's part of our family, and the tears upon departure and my tears, you know, I remember taking her, you know, to SFO to get on the plane to go back to China. And I was a wreck, because this is a woman who has helped me do a job that is a home job, right? The job of raising children is not a singular job.
Yeah. It takes so much, and it takes so many hands and so many, you know, like loving hands. And I love that. I mean, I think that that's, I want that to be the norm, right? I want that to be part of the conversation. And I think, I don't want people to stop hiring people. What I want are better wages for those workers. I want us to value that work overall in society. And, you know, it's not on you as an individual to figure out how to compensate. I mean, you will wrestle with those things, but it's not on individual families to remake the structure, right? Like, these are structural problems. We don't guarantee family leave. We don't guarantee affordable childcare. American families know, really, until your child is six and can go to a public school, you are on your own for figuring out childcare. And so that's the thing. And it's all, we, you know, it's like, it's in the home, it's private, it's hidden. And like, no. The home is a workplace. And, you know, with your IE, it is a site of the international transfer of money, right? Like, it affects immigration, right? It affects so many things. Like, this is a big part of the global economy, and we don't name it as such, you know? And I think that that's a problem.
It is a huge problem, and it manifests. It makes me think of one of your episodes on the Double Shift, the podcast that you hosted, in which a woman was receiving the child tax credit when it existed during COVID. And she was also on welfare. And it struck me because she said one of the things that she did with that money, and I was about to say extra money. It's not extra money in my mind.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
Yeah,
I'm with you.
It's like she hired a babysitter, and that led to an improvement in her own mental health. That led to her being more involved with her own community, running for school board. I mean, all of these wonderful things. It was a significant amount of money. Was it thousands of dollars? No, but it was just that enough to enable some breathing room. I was like, good for this woman, good for the government. I was so taken by that because I think there are assumptions about how people will use any kind of financial support right within the hidden walls of their own home.
Yeah, most people just want to use it to get by and make life a little easier. You know, not that it's really any of our business how people choose to spend that money, but it is. People just want the best for their families. And it's like American life is, it's just not working for most families. And that's something that people on the ground know. And that's the thing that I feel, that's what I worry. I'm like, are our lawmakers in touch with this? Like, they're deluding themselves, right?
Elizabeth Warren is, right?
Yes, absolutely. I feel like, I'm like, Katie Porter is, we need more lawmakers who reflect the identity, like the very diverse and changing demographics of America. You know, I think our government is sort of years behind on that. And I think about what government and laws exist for, really. It's to help people hold on to power. In some ways, it's like the government and that system is working exactly as it was designed. So, you know, one thing I wanted to say in terms of when you go back to this question of what will it take, right? I kind of see it as like, it's like a jewel that I'm holding in my hand, and there's many facets to it. And I think that's also, you know, how we'll get social change is like, there's, you know, I'm so grateful for people like the National Domestic Workers Alliance who have been, you know, on Capitol Hill, who are testifying this week because we have a National Domestic Worker Bill of Rights that's been introduced, into Congress. And they've been doing this work for a long time. And I think I was talking earlier about, you know, that very grassroots community solidarity with other families and other parents. I really think the kind of next step, and I want to like lovingly and gently challenge and push listeners, especially listeners with any kind of financial privilege or any kind of extra flexibility, is to look for solidarity with the people who we hire to do this work. You know, the majority of women who do childcare and domestic labor are mothers themselves, which of course begs the question, who is taking care of their children when they're working for you? I think it's just really important to name that, in fact, we are no different from the people we hire to do this work. And I think that's a really hard thing for people, especially white women, to let go of and to sort of, I get it. You know what I mean? I think that I'll say this to say that I do get it. I mean, I have been mistaken. I'm married to a man who's white. My children are mixed race. I have multiple times been mistaken for my daughter's caretaker or like my daughter's nanny, right? And in the moment, it's a very humbling and sort of destabilizing moment. I've been so angry about it. And then when I sit with it, I have to ask myself, why am I so angry? Because I am their caretaker. It's not an insult, right? Like, but I mean, there's an element to it. There's assumptions that are made. Again, it's one of all of these things are complicated. And I'm just like, let's start talking about them because that's the first step to doing anything. But I really feel like if we can, like through something like this National Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, if we can guarantee a living wage for domestic workers, if we can guarantee worker protections, we're actually one step closer to asking and guaranteeing and demanding those things for parents.
So you're talking about a line to paid leave. You're talking about what does the path look like? Right. Okay.
Yes. If we're valuing and we're guaranteeing these things for the people that we hire to do this work in our home, then people who are, you know, stay-at-home parents, people for whom like that is their full-time job, who don't get any compensation, I think we're actually closer to asking for those things because we're saying this work matters, whoever is doing it.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, Season 2 is here. Hosted every week by me, X-Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season 2 of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
You've said before in one of the episodes on The Double Shift, as women of color, we sometimes feel if white people care about it, then more people will notice. And I think you were saying that in the context of paid leave. But who are the more people that you refer to in that quote? I mean, I think I have an idea. But are we talking about corporations who have the ability to offer paid family leave? Are we talking about privatized childcare and early education? Can you just talk us through, because I think it'll be helpful. I identify as a white woman. You know, I've never felt discriminated against acutely, but I really stop, and I have stopped in prior episodes talking about what I think you're getting at in this quote.
Yeah, I mean, so white people are not a monolith, right? I want to say that. I understand that, yes. Right? But when white people, which is to say, you know, the dominant culture and the sort of like the narratives that we get told, the pictures that we have of like mothers, right? When white people care about an issue, like white people, I'm talking like affluent white people, middle-class white people, you know, lower-income white people who occupy many different jobs and many different spaces. And so to me, that's like when white people start talking about things, like then I see like a shift in the culture a little bit, right? And so I feel sort of hopeful that, it's sad. I feel like sometimes I'm like, it's not enough for us people of color, even though like we will soon be the majority in this country, it's not enough for us to insist on our full humanity. It's not enough to insist on like the value of care and the need for changes in our structure. It's kind of like I see it as sort of like the tide turning, right? And like these are people who that people listen to.
You've also said in the past that mothering can be a form of activism, and we are all mothers, right? That's maybe one place of connection to start. And I think that perspective shift you had when someone assumed that you were the caregiver and you kind of held on to that and embraced it and turned it on its head, that's part of this connection we can feel in that we are all mothering, parenting, raising up the next generation. How else can mothering be a form of activism?
I was missing this idea in my childhood that I was enough just as I am. Right. I don't have to do anything to prove my worth. I shouldn't have to do anything to prove that I deserve healthcare and a house. I mean, housing, to have basic body autonomy, which is not guaranteed in this country. And I think about, you know, this is the sort of activism in that. I mean, I don't know exactly like what my children will believe, but I know that I have a strong influence in how they will come up in the world. And I want to make things a little less difficult for them. I think about a lot of things that I had to unlearn in order to arrive at the place where I am now, where I feel like I know that I am enough. And I want them to have that earlier. Right. And so that's really what it is. I mean, I think about how my parents were very focused on survival and fitting in, right? So we didn't talk about racism. We didn't talk about white supremacy. And so those are conversations that, I mean, I think about it, like if you don't talk to your children about race, somebody else will. And for me, I can't take that risk. So, you know, I talk to my daughters about things that I don't know. I mean, I think some people think you're supposed to shelter children from difficult ideas. And to me, it's a disservice to not talk to them about the realities of the world. Part of this book was to remind myself of the power and the value and the pleasure of doing this work. Because when I'm not overwhelmed, when I can share the load, when I feel like I'm taking care of myself and I am a whole person, then I can show up to my children, and really, and participate in this work knowing like I am doing something to make the world a better place, even if it's just in a small way, even if it's just for these few people who are in my community, who I directly interact with, that means something. That has to mean something. And I do also think if we make those changes, if many of us do those things, it does add up.
I do want to ask you, we are in a threadbare childcare system, right? It is bursting at the seams. How do you think the overturning of Roe versus Wade will further stress that system?
I've had a really hard time. I've seen, like, I've known that the end of Roe is coming, right? I think logically I've understood that for the better part of a year. But I've been really thrown off by its official end because I wasn't ready for... The thing that I associate with is like, it's a very violent end, right? I think about the blood, the death of like, people are really, people are going to die because of this. And people being forced into childbirth and into motherhood, like it's really, it's so upsetting to me. And so I'm a little raw about it, to be totally honest. But the thing that I think about a lot is, there's so many ways to talk about reproductive justice and to talk about Roe. But one of the ways that I find the most clarifying is to talk about it as an issue of economic justice and opportunity. And so the people who have not been able to access abortion, because they have not been able to for years now, are people who are, you know, low income, mostly people of color in the Midwest and in the South. The majority of people who have abortions in America every year are already parents. So these are people who are very familiar with the emotional, but also the financial cost of having children. And so when we force people into motherhood, I think we are really forcing them into economic hardship and poverty. And that will only strain the system even more. And, you know, we're going to see children not tended to. People are working and trying to make ends meet. And if they can't afford childcare, I think people will rely on community as they always have. You know, oppressed people, marginalized people, and people of color in America have always been good at making community and taking care of each other and, you know, making kin and family in different ways. So we'll see more of that, but we will also see, I'm scared for what we'll see. We'll see more parents under stress, more parents stretched to their limit, and children will suffer for that.
I know. It makes me think of the stat that, you know, in all these other industries across the country, employment numbers have come back to just about pre-COVID levels, except in childcare. Like, people are not going back to those roles, which are so important in this country. I've said it a million times. We will educate you. You can have lots of letters behind your name to make you very qualified to care for young children, but you cannot enter an industry that is paying poverty level wages. Angela, I just have to say thank you so much for your work. I have so many more excerpts from your book, Essential Labor, Mothering is Social Change, because there are so many times I was just stopped and I just had to reread sentences. You're so talented, and I'm so grateful that you're out there and that you choose to write about these issues that we all need to understand. So thank you so, so much.
Oh, thank you, Gloria. Thank you for reading with such care and for having me on. This has been such a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Wow. I mean, that was amazing. I love that she talks to herself in the mirror. Have you guys ever done that? I have. It feels really silly for a split second, and then it kind of feels like someone is about to put a gold medal around your neck at the Olympics. Seriously, highly recommend it. Get in there and look at yourself and tell yourself you are essential, and then get moving to change the status quo, because the status quo is truly awful. Angela's book is Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. Go get it, read it. She is a beautiful writer. It will fire you up. And one more very important thing before we go. You may have noticed we took a little break over the last few weeks from featuring your voices at the end of each show. We had been hearing from you, and it was fantastic and one of my favorite parts of the show. They were snapshot reminders of how no one is alone in this caregiving, this parenting role. But then the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, and we felt like we needed to talk about that too. So we scrambled. But the thing is, I have missed your voices. So we want to invite you back, but in a slightly different way. There are all of these overlapping crises that accompany being a parent in America today. The end of Roe, a childcare crisis, a never-ending pandemic, the list goes on. And it's really got me wondering about the future and how this no one is coming to save us community is thinking about it. So here's what I want you to answer. In light of the decision to overturn Roe versus Wade and the high cost and inaccessibility of childcare in this country, would you want, or would you want someone you care about, to become pregnant in the next year? Why or why not? So talk to me. It's super simple to do, I promise. Just open the Voice Memo app on your phone and record a quick message. Then email it to me at gloria@lemonadamedia.com. I cannot wait to hear what you send in. It makes me feel less alone just inviting you back to this space. Okay, love you guys. That's it from me. I'll see you back here next week. No One Is Coming to Save Us is a Lemonada Media original, presented by and created with Neighborhood Villages. The show is produced by Chrissy Pease, Alex McOwen, and Martine Macias. Our mix is by Johnny Vince Evans. Music is by Hannes Brown. Our VP of weekly content is Steve Nelson. Our executive producers are Stephanie Whittles-Wax, Jessica Cordova-Kramer, and me, Gloria Riviera. If you like the show and you believe what we are doing is important, please help others find us by leaving us a rating and writing us a review. Do you have your own experiences and frustrations with the childcare system? Do you have ideas for what we could do to make it better? Join the No One Is Coming to Save Us Facebook group, where we can continue this conversation together. You can also follow us and other Lemonada Media podcasts at Lemonada Media across all social platforms. Thank you guys so much for listening. We will be back next week. Until then, hang in there. You can do this. We got this.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people, and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Paul F. Tompkins.
I'm Lauren Lapkus.
I'm Scott Aukerman, and together we make up the show Freedom! Freedom is a show where the three of us, who are comedians and also friends, we all just hang out, we tell stories about each other and about ourselves.
Usually. We're constantly telling stories about each other.
You got it, Rapaldi.
And we play games and we laugh a lot. It's just that simple. It's a really easy podcast.
This is a pretty good representation of the show.
It's actually exactly what it is, plus singing.
So listen to it now. The new season's out. Get it wherever you get your podcast.
Just go outside and scream freedom.
Just like we do.
Freedom! Freedom! Freedom!